This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. It's been a while since we've had a dramatic reading. Shall we start with a dramatic reading?
The climatic changes that may be produced by the increased CO2 content could be deleterious from the point of view of human beings.
This is the very first government report to mention climate change, submitted to President Lyndon Johnson in 1965.
The possibilities of deliberately bringing about countervailing climatic changes, therefore, need to be thoroughly explored.
The report lays out the sources of CO2, fossil fuels, the possible downsides of global warming, which you know already, and then, without even momentary contemplation of ceasing emissions, pivots directly to this.
A change in the radiation balance in the opposite direction to that which might result from the increase of atmospheric CO2 could be produced by raising the albedo, or reflectivity, of the Earth. Such a change of albedo could be brought about, for example, by spreading very small, reflecting particles over large oceanic areas.
Just to lay it out, this report is saying global warming is a problem, yes, but to solve it, we could just spread something reflective over all of the oceans, like glitter, for example. 5 million square miles of them. That's less than 4% of the surface area of the world's salt water. This might be the original sin of what's called geoengineering. Reading this makes it feel like we gave up on avoiding climate change before it had even really started. The report even estimates what it would cost. It says it would be pretty cheap.
Thus, a 1% change in reflectivity might be brought about for about $500 million a year. Considering the extraordinary economic and human importance of climate, costs of this magnitude do not seem excessive.
Why try to address a pollution problem with more pollution? I mean, just to be clear, that's what this is.
This is Gernot Wagner, a tricky name to pronounce for Americans.
Gernot Wagner, juggernaut without the jug.
Gernot is the co-founder of Harvard's Solar Geoengineering Research Program. Recently, I spent a couple of days interviewing people from that program, and this story is based largely on those interviews. Geoengineering, as in climate control. It's the idea that we should deliberately change the world's climate even more than we already have in order to counteract the effects of our carbon emissions. Not many folks are talking about pouring glitter into the oceans anymore. Instead, much of the focus is on the idea that we should deploy a massive fleet of planes all over the world, which would spray tiny reflective particles very high up in the atmosphere.
Everything we seem to know about climate policy reverses with solar geoengineering. It is so cheap.
What Gernot is saying is that, crazy as that may seem, dimming the sun with tiny particles is much cheaper than the alternatives.
Literally, just the engineering costs of dumping that stuff into the lower stratosphere costs sort of, single-digit billions of dollars a year. Relative to sort of the trillions of dollars that unmitigated climate change costs, and relative to the single-digit trillions of dollars that it would cost to stop polluting altogether, cutting CO2 emissions to zero.
For more than 50 years now, this idea has tickled our imaginations. The allure is that it's a get-out-of-jail-free card, the ultimate indulgence sold by the Church of Technology for our sins of inadvertent climate modification. Of course, a lot of you are probably already shouting, but what about the side effects? But frankly, before we can even get to the side effects, there's another big problem for this technology.
This is what I think is so interesting about geoengineering as an emerging, like quote-unquote emerging technology, is that it's like not really emerging.
This is Jane Flagle, a professor at Arizona State University. She says that geoengineering is not really a thing. It's a hypothesis which has been tested almost entirely with nothing except for computer simulations, climate models, many of which simply turn down how much heat from the sun is coming in through the atmosphere just to see what happens. We're not sure if the engineering of getting the shiny particles up there would actually work. We have a pretty minimal understanding of what the unintended consequences might be. We're not even sure how long they would actually stay up there in the atmosphere or if they just clump together and fall to the Earth. It's all very, very hypothetical.
we have been stuck at this kind of research impasse for, I mean, I've been working on this for a decade, and not much has changed.
Why the impasse? Why is a technology that was the knee-jerk response to climate change by government scientists more than 50 years ago still in its infancy? Well, because for decades, this subject has been verboten. Sure, we were scared of possible side effects, but we were also scared of what it would mean if we talked about this too much. The existence of a get-out-of-jail-free card means you're not worried about going to jail. So maybe geoengineering should stay hypothetical.
This topic is insane, so giddy up.
Today we are talking about dealing with climate change by dimming the sun. An idea so fraught that it's been relegated to the scientific sidelines for 50 years. But as we hurtle towards a substantially warmer world, it's an idea that's gotten a lot of attention lately. And even if we might not want to think about it, it's an idea that we may be stuck with, like it or not. When we look at environmental problems, plastic in the ocean, overfishing, water quality, the first response is usually that we need to lower our impact on natural systems. But to embrace geoengineering is to embrace the opposite, that if we've got our thumb on one side of the scale, we should put the other thumb on the other side of the scale. It's a term that's been used to mean a lot of things. But today, we're mostly going to be talking about one particular technology, reflecting sunlight by spraying lots of tiny particles into the upper atmosphere to reflect back the sun's rays. It's called solar radiation management, SRM, a name that was actually invented to be as boring as possible so that NASA scientists would be allowed to attend conferences about it. And in reality, we're not actually talking about the nuts and bolts of that technology. You can find that on the internet. We're talking about the ideas that this technology forces us to grapple with. So, if this is an idea that's been around since the 60s or earlier, when did it suddenly get for real? Well, got a big boost when a high-profile essay came out back in 2006.
Well, I heard about it because Steve Schneider, who is the author of Climatic Change, actually asked me to write one of the commentaries about it, but I was too busy and never got around to writing one, which I should have done.
This is David Keefe, who has been studying geoengineering since before climate change was an intractable political morass, since the late 80s. This essay was by an atmospheric physicist named Paul Crutzen, who had helped to draw attention to the growing hole in the ozone and who popularized the term Anthropocene. The term that means humans have changed the world so much that we've now defined a new geologic era. In the essay, he said we should be seriously studying and considering geoengineering.
So then why do you think this one article by this one scientist did matter?
I think the obvious, because he's a Nobel Prize winner, he's very highly respected in the climate science community, and one of the most discussed risks of one kind of solar geoengineering was damaging the ozone layer, and Crutzen was most famous for understanding the chemistry of the ozone layer. So the fact that he, who nobody could accuse of not understanding risk to ozone layer, would say that we should look at this seriously, really damp down or make people rethink some of the objections they'd had.
Following the 2006 article, research spiked, up from just a few articles a year in the early aughts to more than 150 a year in 2014. And it was driven mostly by scientists.
I thought it might be economists or politicians or people jazzed about this as kind of a cheap and easy way out who were investigating it. But I found that 70% of the assertions made in the media were by scientists.
This is Holly Buck, a researcher at UCLA who got interested in all of this geoengineering talk after hearing some conservative economists promoting it on a panel she went to.
The other thing I found was that only 3% of the assertions about geoengineering were made by women. The other 97%, it was men describing this, men constructing what it means and explaining it to people.
Why might this be? It's low-hanging fruit, but also probably kind of dumb to suggest that there's something quintessentially masculine about this idea.
Yeah, it seems like an easy answer, but I don't want to have some essentialist, ecofeminist perspective that women are naturally more attuned to nature, which may or may not be the case, but I'd like to see a future where, you know, women create and use awesome technologies too. So
it's also true that reporters are kind of sexist and tend, on average, to quote male researchers something like 5 times more often than female ones. But 97%? That's particularly bad. Maybe just as compelling an explanation, this subject was taboo. So the people who are researching this stuff have to be pretty safe and comfortable. Established academic careers, tenured faculty, in hard sciences. Generally speaking, positions that have gone disproportionately to men.
It's this very, very small group. People call it the geo-clique.
But Jane Flagel points out, this is still a tiny, tiny field.
So the handful of scientists who really want to see this move forward, who I think are well-intentioned, like I do believe that people think that this might be a very important tool for managing climate risk. I mean, I think they also are interested in like winning scientific prizes, but I do believe that people are well-meaning. This group of relatively small group of actors, scientists, have been trying for a long time now to conjure demand for their research. And they've been remarkably unsuccessful. And I think it's because, at base, the question of whether or not to generate knowledge about this is a, like, values question. So no amount of science is going to resolve it, really, is my view.
So why the taboo? Why is it that, at least for the time being, this values question has been answered with a lot of squirming in chairs, with squeamishness, with unwillingness to go there? It's because geoengineering is not actually a solution to climate change. It's a Band-Aid. And as Taylor Swift has said, Band-Aids don't fix bullet holes.
I actually usually compare it to people and tell people it's like opioids.
This is Frank Koich, another Harvard geoengineering researcher.
Like these very strong painkillers that have a lot of risk associated with them. And what they do is they usually don't actually fix the problem. What it does is it lessens symptoms. And the other thing is that, you know, it's a foreign substance that you put in your body that is going to have some toxicity, right? So, you know, it can damage your liver, it can do all kinds of things. And the same thing is true, that the idea that you can put a million tons of something into the stratosphere and it'll have no side effects, I think, you know, probably is a utopia that does not exist.
So you might be in the camp that's saying right now, yeah, but painkillers make the pain go away, so why not use them to get rid of the pain?
Even though from a scientific perspective, that makes less than zero sense.
In reality, you've got to address the disease and not the symptoms. So spending research dollars and lavishing media attention on a drug that makes the symptoms go away sends the wrong message. Especially if, just like some painkillers, the solution might be worse than the disease.
So if you did geoengineering, if you, like, let's imagine you do a sulfate aerosol injection and some, like, whatever, you spray stuff in the sky, you're blocking the sun. And in the meantime, you continue to emit greenhouse gases, increasing emissions even, you end up in a situation where you have to do more and more and more and more geoengineering to compensate for the heating effects of the greenhouse gases, which is like, would be an insane thing to do.
To stick with the analogy here, imagine dealing with back pain by just upping the dose of painkillers while still doing the activity that's causing the back pain day after day.
And there is the risk that if the system, the socio-technical system that is supplying the geoengineering, fails for whatever reason or stops, you could have rapid onset of warming that was a consequence of the continued emissions of greenhouse gases.
Right. There's a term for this, right? It's like termination shock.
Yeah, yeah.
If you stop cold turkey, you'll go through withdrawal. And withdrawal from some drugs can actually kill you. So even just talking about this idea, drawing attention to it, means that some folks who haven't taken the time to study the nuances will leap to the wrong conclusions.
Well, I think there's something we call the super freakonomics flip.
This is Peter Irvine, another gentleman from the geoengineering research squad at Harvard. If somehow you have not heard of it, Freakonomics was a book. And its sequel, Super Freakonomics, has a section on geoengineering.
And in their second book, they said, oh, climate change is way too expensive to deal with. Oh, but look, here's this solar geoengineering idea. It's really cheap.
problem solved, done. You know, it's kind of, climate change isn't a problem, but now that we've got something cheap, it's a problem, we fixed it. That flip is what some people are worried about.
The lesson of the Superfreakonomics flip is that folks who are inclined to think climate change is too hard of a problem can quickly pivot to geoengineering. It's a fantasy. We can have our cake and eat it too. No need to lower carbon emissions. We've got shiny particles. But here's the thing. Virtually everyone who's studying this technology believes it should be used only as a stopgap. They think, yeah, painkillers are good for helping you get on with your life while you fix the root cause of your problems, but you've got to fix that root cause. But even though all of the researchers studying this know all of these caveats, the problem is that outsiders don't.
It does, in fact, look too good.
Last year, Gernot Wagner did a study where he estimated the, quote, raw, dumb engineering costs of what it would take to spray reflective particles into the atmosphere day after day, year after year, until we've reduced emissions. Some hapless digital news producer at CNN who had never heard of the idea before noticed the study.
Well, anyway, so he picks up this study somehow. No idea how he found it. And basically writes one of these headlines, sort of Harvard scientists discover solution to climate change kind of thing.
So I'm just reading here. Dimming the sun, the answer to global warming.
Yes.
So scientists are proposing an ingenious but as yet unproven way to tackle climate change.
There are lots of side effects of geoengineering that we aren't sure about. What will it do to the Arctic? What will this mean for the oceans? What will it do to the ozone layer? Gernot Wagner knows that his study doesn't answer any of those questions. He knows that it's more complicated than just calculating the raw, dumb costs. But the public? Not so much. This side effect, which we might call the silver bullet problem, is undeniably real. And it happens all the time. Because the lay public, journalists, people who are understandably freaked out about climate change, love the idea of a quick fix.
But yeah, so this CNN report came out, if you can call it a report, came out sort of Friday after Thanksgiving. And then by Saturday morning, sort of wee hours of Saturday, this study was trending with the Kardashians. So sort of competing with the Kardashians for the number one trending news spot on Twitter for a few hours. So it turns out one of the sisters apparently didn't spend Thanksgiving with the family, and that was, you know, that was a problem. I did spend way too much time on this. She was with her basketball boyfriend or something, who happens to be playing a game that evening or something. So it wasn't that she wasn't pissed at her sisters, it was because she spent Thanksgiving with her boyfriend, right? Scandal.
So a somewhat falsified version of a Kardashian story was competing with a somewhat falsified version of the write-up of your study.
Exactly, right? So, you know, and then once Questlove and, you know, Chance the Rapper or a parody account for Chance the Rapper and so on are tweeting about your environmental research letters paper, right, you know that something has gone horribly wrong.
So as much as the researchers involved might want this technology to be used in a responsible way, in a way that simply reduces the harm that climate change might cause, the rest of us out here, we're still looking for that silver bullet. And every new social media intern who learns about this thing and thinks they've found that silver bullet is going to tweet about it as such. When a complicated idea is easily misunderstood, it's going to get misunderstood. And once a narrative gets away from you, it can be hard to get back. After a quick break, a story of a narrative gone wild. Welcome back to Outside In. Today we're talking about dimming the sun, an idea that's getting increasingly mainstream.
Underneath all the noise of individual headlines and wild claims about how this is all driven by the oil companies or it's our savior or it's complete bullshit, there's, you know, actually been a pretty steady movement in the core of the climate science community and the climate science advocacy community to take this topic seriously, which doesn't mean we should necessarily do it, but the idea that, in fact, the taboo is wrong.
This is David Keith, again, one of the original gangsters of solar geoengineering research. David and a lot of the folks studying this technology think we have to study it, even though they also think it would be preferable if we didn't have to use it.
It does make sense to study. It makes sense to study it seriously with all the tools we have of climate science to understand how it might be used to reduce climate risks, what its risks itself might be, and how it might be governed in a divided world. And I think there's actually steady growth of agreement that we should do that work.
But also, if climate change does become really bad, we might need that painkiller. Here's Josh Horton, also from Harvard.
There still is this hope that we can still get things right. I think that's not right. I think that is aspirational, but if you look at the numbers and the trajectories and look at it realistically, we're in pretty bad shape. And we're going to need some other things to help us get out of this mess.
If we need the poison pill, and we wind up turning to it, it will be worse if we haven't thought about whether it works, what the side effects are, or the best way to govern it. Gernot Wagner puts this another way.
If anything, the name of the game now is to stop people, countries, from doing it too soon, too much, stupidly.
And it's kind of hard to argue with that. More knowledge is good, right? Who would argue for less knowledge? Well, here's the fear.
My name is Penny Chisholm, and I am an institute professor at MIT. I study microbes in the ocean.
Over a decade ago, Penny was involved in some of the foundational research that inspired another geoengineering scheme. This one was called ocean iron fertilization.
I study phytoplankton in the oceans that are the base of the food web, and we study a particular group called Prochlorococcus. And one of the things that you need to understand about the oceans is what nutrients limit their growth. And there, at the time, there was a hypothesis that iron was an important limiting nutrient. Before that, we thought...
It's a little complicated, but the short version of this idea is that if you just add a little bit of iron to certain parts of the ocean, it unlocks the power of this algae, and it allows it to grow like crazy.
When you add the limiting nutrient, in this case was iron, the waters turn green because of these phytoplankton blooms.
But after a quick bloom, all of these little plants die and sink to the bottom of the ocean, carrying with them a whole bunch of carbon dioxide. This relationship was observed by a scientist named John Martin.
He had this throwaway line, give me a tanker of iron and I'll give you an ice age. And because of that, when this experiment was done, which was done as a basic research experiment, it was interpreted as a geoengineering experiment. And so it got press coverage in that way.
That somewhat unwelcome press attention fed on itself.
It felt like more and more as I tried to articulate the risks and the downsides and the science that we know that people were not factoring in, it seemed like the more momentum the idea would get.
The basic science that Penny was involved in doing was showing that this was a really, really bad idea. When you add iron, the algae does grow, but then there's a domino effect.
You're guaranteed certain things.
It dies, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean, and it starts to break down. The chemical reactions use up the oxygen that's in the water, and when the oxygen is gone, two things happen. The oceans start producing methane,
which is a stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
And all the fish that need that oxygen die. To cap it all off, even doing this in all of the world's oceans wouldn't stop global warming.
The models show it doesn't have much of an impact whatsoever on the trajectory of global warming. So there's really nothing that argues that this should even be considered, shouldn't even be in the portfolio of geoengineering proposals.
In other words, after some very basic modeling, we learned that this particular geoengineering scheme, which is totally different from the spraying stuff in the atmosphere scheme that we've been talking about so far, was a terrible idea. And even though scientists knew that, scientists didn't get to control how it got talked about.
Thank you. Your inspiration and your vision. Thank you.
This is an event that Penny participated in back in 2012. The Dalai Lama came to Boston and sat in for a presentation at MIT. Ocean iron was still a pretty hot topic back then, and Penny was asked to present to His Holiness Tenzin Gyatso about why it's a terrible idea. The whole scene was pretty stilted. There was a translator there, time was short, but still, after her spiel...
Whether we can really solve this problem or not, really, time comes, we have to make an attempt. as I feel.
That's the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama saying that we should consider it. The allure of these ideas is powerful, and if they can be misunderstood, they will be.
I finally sort of stopped talking about it for a while to get it off the radar screen.
Like reporters would call and you're just like, no response.
I would say, yeah, I would say I would send them copies of my articles, actually. I mean, I'd say, this is what I have to say.
Yeah, nothing shuts a day-turn reporter up quicker than being sent a scientific paper. They're like, what am I supposed to do with this?
So, yes, knowledge for knowledge's sake is good, but you can't control how people see these silver bullet ideas. And never mind people, what about governments? As climate change gets worse, there's going to be pressure on countries to do something about it. And silver bullets are going to be very, very attractive. And while it might be a good idea to think and talk about systems for global governance that would work to keep this technology in check, can you really govern something when you can't even control the narrative about it?
So it's how on earth would you get countries to agree? How would you address countries' legitimate demands that if something goes wrong, they aren't left out to dry, that they get compensated, that there's procedures to modify or even halt geoengineering? It's not clear that we could resolve that easily. And so that's politics. It's deciding that in a way that's, in theory at least, inclusive and legitimate and wise and thoughtful. That might be too much to ask for, but that would be the goal, I think.
When you lay it out in all of those complexities, it sounds impossible.
It may be impossible to do it in an ideal way.
Just to hammer home the challenge here, one last story. So, ocean iron fertilization, the geoengineering idea that once we did some modeling seemed like it wouldn't actually work. Here's Penny Chisholm again.
I think it was in 2012, a person named Russ George, who actually fertilized, allegedly, well, he claims to have fertilized a 10,000 square mile region off British Columbia, ostensibly to stimulate the salmon fishery there, but also to sell carbon credits.
Just to jump in here really quickly, for one, it was 10,000 square kilometers, not miles. But anyway, this is how the scheme was sold, as a way to generate and sell carbon offsets. And he just went ahead and did it. International waters, didn't ask permission, didn't tell any big international governing body he was doing it. He just gave it a whirl and dumped a whole goddamn cargo ship of iron into the freaking ocean.
To this day, there is no evidence or data from that experiment, but it does show you what can happen when these ideas are out there. And it's not hard for a single individual to manipulate ecosystems on a large scale when you've figured out what the triggers are.
I don't want to make too much of this story. It would actually probably be pretty hard to do substantial amounts of geoengineering. Like, if one guy decided he was going to take control of the world's thermostat, world governments could always just sink his ships or shoot down his planes. But what about a superpower? What if things got bad enough for Russia, the US, or China to consider it? So in a way, we've become trapped. We've pinned ourselves with the allure of our own possibly flawed idea.
Because the broader context is that scientists are in a position where their jobs depend on arguing for more research.
Holly Buck again, from UCLA.
Kind of unfortunately true in a lot of situations where research funding is scarce, it's competitive. They might have to attract money from philanthropists who really want to be funding something that's going to be splashy or successful, rather than, you know, how we think science is supposed to work. You should be free to find some results, and if they're negative, that's science too, right? We need those. We need to know those things. And I think the issue is kind of one of science being broken.
look, I am in philanthropy now, and this question about the role of private money in the space, I think, is increasingly relevant. You know, and it's private money does not always mean like nefarious money, but you could have like well-meaning philanthropists who get interested in seeing this move forward. There's also like private universities and, you know, you just potentially companies, I guess. And we don't have great democratic mechanisms for overseeing that.
In a way, just as we as a society are trapped by the allure of this idea, so too are they as scientists. While some universities may fear to tread in this space, others will dive right in, and wealthy, freaked-out climate benefactors will step up to pay for it. In fact, Harvard's research team will, at some point in the very near future, launch a weather balloon equipped to spray a small amount of calcium carbonate into the stratosphere, a trial which, unlike the hundreds of pounds of particles we emit from commercial airliners every moment, will be conducted deliberately. That geoengineering research program is paid for by tens of millions of private donations, the headlining funder of which is Bill Gates himself, personally. Trying to stop climate change is hard, but so is reporting on it. Coming up, we'll hear about a new project from NHPR that aims to cover climate more deliberately. That's after a break. Welcome back. I'm Outside In, and this... Welcome back. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, and this is Outside In. The daunting size and scope of climate change as a global problem can make it hard for individuals to know how to respond. What power do I have to make change? How will this affect me? But it can make it hard for people whose job it is to report on this stuff, too. That's why I am so excited to witness, and perhaps to contribute to, a new project at NHPR called By Degrees, a deliberate effort to report on how the New England region is living through and responding to climate change. Spearheading the effort is NHPR's current environmental reporter, Annie Ropeek. Hey, Annie.
Hi, Sam.
Okay, so you have been here for NHPR for a couple of years now, and I'm curious if you are finding it as hard as I did, and sometimes do still, like, to focus on climate change.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that actually, it's funny to hear you say that, because that was sort of the place we were coming from when we started talking about this project, like, almost a year ago. I mean, we were finding that it was really hard to keep climate change front and center. And even when it was on our plates, to do it justice in the daily grind of the news reporting and the primary. And, you know, I also cover our seacoast region just generally and not just about the environment. And I have like 9 jobs. And so we sort of took a step back and said, okay, what would it look like if we were to carve out some space for this, try to approach this topic in a more intentional, organized, consistent way? And a year later and a pandemic in progress and a racial upheaval and economic crash later, here we are.
Yeah. It's so crazy, too, because it does seem like climate is a subject that it clearly touches on like every aspect of our lives. And so there's so many ways in to talking about climate. But still, the impacts are always talked about as being so far away that there's always something so much more immediate. But I guess, have you been thinking about this project differently in the past few months with everything that's been going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had to completely reframe it a couple of times over. I'm almost glad that we were pushed to really turn up the framing around how it intersects with racial justice and how it intersects with public health and economic development, because all those things, you know, were important in our original concept of what this would be, but now they are really part of the top-level framing of this. I mean, this is a project about how we are experiencing climate change during those other crises. And I think that's the right story to tell. It's a better story to tell than just climate change is happening or climate change is going to happen, because those are the stories we've heard before. And I think those don't really sink into people's minds anymore at a certain point.
It's really funny that you talk about how it can be hard to get folks to tune in for climate stories, because we just did this listener survey over at Outside In, and 600 responses, and one of the questions that we asked was, what are stories that you skip? And like in that, there was a subcategory of responses that was just like anything that is like clearly from the outset about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's the challenge. You know, and we don't want to be doom and gloom. Like that was hard for me as a reporter to continue to just tell the same old stories about how bad it was going to be and how much we weren't doing. I mean, it's not that those things have changed, far from it, but I think I want to shake people loose from that expectation and get them to like re-engage with this topic in a new way, because that's what I've been doing and I've found it to be really inspiring and exciting. I'm not saying it's going to be sunshine and rainbows the whole way, far from it, but but you know, it's a place to start.
Has anyone looked into the impact of climate change on frequency of rainbows?
Of sunshine and rainbows? Yeah, I just saw a rainbow on Monday last night. And I was like, it's an omen for my climate change project.
So we will talk more about the project as a whole in a few minutes. But first, I just want to play one of the first features that you put together for ByDegrees. It's a really timely piece about what it takes to make big shifts in our lifestyles and attitudes. So let's listen.
Sherry Schmidt is a teacher in Bedford who describes herself as eco-conscious. She says she and her husband have always tried to recycle and compost. But when they had to start staying home due to COVID-19, they found themselves doing a lot more.
We're being very careful about food waste. Because obviously it's not like you can just drop everything and run to the grocery store anytime you want to. Thinking about what do you use for personal household supplies, like paper towels. Maybe it's better if we're not going through so much of that because we can use things that we already have around the house.
Driving less, shopping less, finding new ways to reduce and reuse. The changes Schmidt made in response to the coronavirus are some of the things scientists say can help reduce the carbon emissions that drive climate change. Globally, the coronavirus-related shutdowns led to a 17% drop in emissions by mid-spring, though that trend has reversed as life has begun to resume. Still, if lots of people could quickly form new habits like this during the pandemic, why didn't they do it sooner, knowing the need to act on climate change? Schmidt has an idea.
Well, I think it's because, unfortunately, that's part of the human condition. You know, people don't tend to want to focus on something until it's in a crisis state.
Social scientists say she's right. Suzanne Moser with Antioch University in Keene says the way we talk about climate change makes it feel distant compared to something like the pandemic.
I have COVID going on right now. I have no job. I have kids to deal with. I mean, those are the kinds of things that tend to get our attention much more easily.
The threat of COVID-19 is immediate and easy to visualize. That ubiquitous image of the spiky red ball and our family and friends masked or in hospital beds. There are clear and impactful ways to show we care and we're doing something about it, like wearing masks in public. The urgency of it got policymakers to act relatively quickly and decisively. Climate change, on the other hand, has dawned on us slowly through predictions, scenarios, things that can sound hypothetical. Scientists have had to work for decades to get their consensus to sink in that human activity is causing the problem.
When you then start a policy, you have to acknowledge that we're actually at fault. That's so not something you want to be caught with as a politician.
Add a dose of economic fear and a powerful competing interest in the fossil fuel industry, and Moser says what might have been a straightforward call to action became political. And that's actually what she says is happening now in the pandemic. The big changes didn't last. States reopened quickly in fear for their economies, only to see COVID-19 cases spike. This might seem like a bad sign for our ability to sustain climate action over the long term. But Moser is still hopeful. She says massive collective changes needed to respond to climate change won't shut down the economy like the pandemic. Instead, they'll create whole new industries and jobs and make people healthier and safer. Emily Diamond studies climate communication at the University of Rhode Island. She's also been watching the response to COVID-19.
If fighting climate change requires massive structural change, we've just demonstrated that we can do it. We've also demonstrated that when there's a threat that's urgent enough, we can really open our coffers in a way that we haven't seen in addressing most other issues besides potentially going to war in the past.
Diamond studies how people's identities shape their response to climate change. She says people are galvanized by threats to their sense of self, like their livelihood or a place they love. And she thinks she's seeing that dynamic at work in an important way this summer, in the unprecedented number of white people joining people of color in protests over police violence. Diamond, who is white, thinks these protesters have probably always thought of themselves as supporters of racial equality, just as people might identify as eco-conscious. Right now, she says people are being confronted with stories that make them feel they aren't who they thought they were, and they haven't done enough.
That act of being called out, I think, is something that's really powerfully motivating.
Diamond says this can be applied to climate change, that people who've felt they cared for a long time should start to do more. She thinks this moment is a call not just to individual action, but to structural change, to confront systemic racism and climate change at the same time.
It's not enough to just carry your reusable bags to the grocery store or maybe sometimes bike to work instead of driving to work. We have to translate this into pressure to create political will and policy changes.
Scientists say climate change and COVID-19 are both disproportionately hurting people of color and low-income communities. Diamond says she hopes activists, scientists, and policymakers will see the links between these issues and start addressing climate change as a matter of justice.
That was NHPR's environmental reporter, Annie Ropeek, in one of the inaugural stories from NHPR's new climate change reporting project called By Degrees. So this project is built in part around trying to answer listener questions about climate, which is great, but I feel like I've found that when you solicit questions about climate, a lot of what people want to know is how they can reduce their personal carbon footprint.
Oh, yeah.
And is there a tension at all between answering those questions and also tackling the bigger systemic issues around the drivers of climate change?
Yes, absolutely. So that is one of the questions we've gotten the most in planning this and just even so far in having it launched is, what can I do? Or what does what I do matter? And it's such a thorny question. Like, it's a dangerous road to go down because, frankly, you know, fossil fuel companies want you to ask that question. You know, that sounds cynical, but that we've seen this before in other environmental stories, for example, with the history of sort of recycling and litter campaigning in this country, that the people who produced the plastic wanted to make it the consumer's problem to get rid of that plastic. And why should that be the case? Why shouldn't the producers be responsible for it? And also, it's not a problem any individual can solve by themselves because it's produced on such a mass scale that is so disconnected from any one person's consumption habits. But that doesn't mean that individual actions don't have an impact. So it's this really complicated cycle. So I think one thing we're heading toward is, in trying to answer those questions, we'll try to help people get some context for how do you even measure the value of an individual action? Is it in what it does to your carbon footprint or how much waste it reduces? But also, you know, help them to see that sometimes action can mean political action. It can mean organizing. It can mean telling five friends something they don't know about climate change. And that stuff can sound, you know, fluffier. But I think that what I hear from a lot of scientists, what we just heard in this story just now, is that that actually can matter as much or more than one person beginning to compost. It can be both. It should be both. And so I'm hoping we can help people understand that and find new ways to sort of frame their individual responsibility. So we want to help give people those tools too.
Annie Ropeek, environmental reporter at NHPR and part of the team behind By Degrees, NHPR's new climate change reporting initiative. You can find the work by heading over to nhpr.org/climate. Once you're there, you can submit your own climate questions and you can maybe have Annie answer them. Thanks so much, Annie.
Thank you.
Before we go today, we've got one last bit of business. It's time to announce the winner of our epic fruit fight from a few weeks ago. In case you missed it, producer Taylor Quimby argued that the spicy pepper was the greatest fruit of all time, or the G-fote, if you will.
One, hot peppers are biological marvels. Two, their unique evolutionary adaptations.
Justine Paradise said that the G-fote was, in fact, the coconut.
You could argue that it made possible one of the greatest human migrations of all time.
Felix Poon argued it was the hard-shelled gourd.
Cold water bottle, smoking pipe, you name it, it probably started off as a gourd.
And I made the case for the vanilla bean. The fact
that vanilla orchids ever get pollinated at all is objectively astonishing. And you, our listeners, voted online for the winner, and now we are gathered here to hear the results. Taylor?
So, I will start from the bottom and move up. Vanilla is in fourth place. In third place is the challenger, defeated the spicy pepper.
Mm. Good effort.
In second place is the gourd, which I really thought was going to win it early on. It had so many votes.
What?
Yeah.
Which means that the greatest fruit of all time, undisputed, can never be challenged again, is the coconut.
Wow. Wait, what was the margin?
144 for the coconut. The gourd was in second at 112. And then 87 for the pepper and 71 for the bean.
Oh, wow.
I think among us, I know that I should be like crowing my victory here, but among us, I would have voted for the gourd. I also want to say that we, people submitted their own fruits that they thought should win, and someone proposed the pawpaw, the idea that the pawpaw actually resisted industrial production, and I really like that argument, and I kind of wish that I'd done the pawpaw for that reason.
Somebody else said rice.
Right. So rice is a fruit?
By our botanical definition, I believe that rice counts as a fruit, but it doesn't have like fleshy bits. It's just like the seed, right? And so I think that's why it doesn't feel like a fruit.
Well, but also, is it a fruit or is it a part of a fruit?
What is the definition of the fruit? Can we get a little reminder?
Let's just...
I thought it was anything that developed from the ovary of a plant.
It's something you eat for dessert.
I should say now that there is one other proposed challenger, and I've got to really give it to this listener named Grant, who went so far as to not just suggest that it is the best fruit, but like went and did his own 5-minute pitch argument.
All right, I am recording a voice memo with the phone up to my ear and my iPhone up to my mouth, and I feel ridiculous. Let's go.
Grant is actually something of a friend of the podcast. We interviewed him for a story about a year ago. And I'd say he's very engaged on social media. So Grant, you have a history of calling us out for choosing the wrong things in our contests, I'd like to point out. Do you remember the last time?
I remember vaguely you were talking about the best animal.
Yes.
And it's clearly the golden retriever, my right. Golden retriever specifically, but you know.
And so he made and recorded his own, like, 5-minute argument in favor.
I propose that the best fruit is the grape.
So his argument was that grapes are delicious.
If we're searching for the best fruit, shouldn't it be at home in a fruit basket or a fruit salad?
Important for society's survival.
When water supplies can't be found or trusted, wine became people's main source of hydration.
Historically significant.
In the New Testament, Jesus' first miracle was turning water into wine at the wedding at Cana. The Quran lists the grape as one of the fruits of paradise.
Culturally relevant. And economically huge.
We grow more grapes by weight than any other fruit, 72 million tons annually, according to the University of Missouri. That yields 7.2 trillion gallons of wine each year. Trillion. And 800,000 tons of raisins.
In conclusion,
if you're seeking the truth about what is the best fruit, in vino veritas, the best fruit is the humble, the historic, the versatile, the great grape.
So Grant's whole pitch, if you want to hear it, is on our website, outsideinradio.org, on the post for the original Fruit Fight episode.
I want to say, like, if other listeners want to do this, I would really want to hear other people's 5-minute pitches for fruits.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Open this contest up.
Should we just, like, honor Grant with maybe some sort of honorary Fruit Spirit Award kind of thing?
What?
Well, let's say, I mean, if he can get 150 votes, well, then I guess he
we
wins.
Could do a head to head. I mean, we could put it, you know, we could put that on Twitter and Facebook and just do the coconut and the grape.
Like any good millennial, he gets a participation award.
Yeah.
All right.
The coconut is the clear winner here. Great job, Justine.
Great job, B-Gun. Thank you to, all of the people that we interviewed. Like, just, it's so much fun to hear from people who are, like, deep in the world of their own fruits or their own branch of science. So,
yeah.
Okay. B is awesome.
Let's do this again with vegetables.
Wait, how do you define a vegetable?
This episode was produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, with Justine Paradise, Taylor Quimby, Felix Poon, Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, Nick Capodice, and Samantha Searles. Eric Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of Blocking Out the Sun. Special thanks this week to Jane Long and Lizzie Burns. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Broke for Free, and Averine. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you.